the more depressed I became, really, at the idea of trying to facilitate change in these organizations that are often so resistant to it and so sort of like ungrateful.
From Tuple, this is Distributed, where we show how world-class engineers and their teams tackle the challenges of remote work. I'm Jack Hanna, your host. Hey, everyone. Today, we're speaking with Matt Nguyen, who is a staff software engineer at Mechanical Orchard, with almost 30 years of experience developing software. Matt has held a number of senior engineering roles at large and small companies alike, and notably founded Cucumber Limited to support the Cucumber open source project that makes automated acceptance testing much easier. So, yeah, Matt, we're excited to have you on. Today, we are going to cover your personal story, how you got involved in the Cucumber project, the challenges with modern software development in general, and what the modern software developer faces, colored by your consulting experience, and how improving how we work together can really make all the difference on all the above. So I'm excited to get into it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
I want to start with some context for folks so that they can orient around your background. I think you first joined the ranks of software development in the late 90s, which were the go-go years, at least in the US of the dot-com era. What was that like for you? Were there any notable stories from your time during those years?
The notable thing about the late 90s was everybody was terrified of the year 2K problem. And everybody sort of says now, oh, you know, it was like we shouldn't have been worried about it. But actually, I think people worked extremely hard so that it didn't have any huge consequences. It was one of those things where mankind actually kind of got together and dealt with an upcoming problem. Actually, the job where I discovered XP was about 2000, 2001. So we were just out after that. And I was sitting in an insurance company writing Visual Basic, VBScript front end for a mainframe system. So like, you know, the way insurance companies and banks kind of wrap a shiny skin on top of their grotty old mainframe. So that was just after that time. We were working with COBOL programmers like day to day. So I had a business analyst who could write database queries and set up data in the database for us. And there were people just sitting amongst us that were writing the stored procedures in COBOL. It's a fascinating time.
Well, it sounds like that was your first experience being exposed to extreme programming or XP, which I understand to be a big part of the way that you develop software today. What was your first impression?
All right. So actually what happened was I had this job for this little consultancy and I had a boss who was like all about agile and he's telling me all about agile. And I was like, what is this? This is not how I got taught to do software development at university. We're supposed to write a requirement spec. This is nonsense. And I was, you know, furious. But it kind of like crept into my mind somewhere. And when I was at the job at this insurance company, I had this two-week period where they'd given me a job, right? And I had a desk and a computer and I could sit down, but I didn't have a login. So I was getting paid to just show up and sit down at a desk. But somebody else, like a friend of mine at work there, lent me her login. And so I could like log in and just basically browse the web because I didn't have anything to do. I couldn't check any emails or anything, even if, you know, there hadn't been anything for me to do. So I just basically used it as a web browser and I found the C2 wiki. And at that time, that was the sort of hotbed, right, of where all of the agile practitioners in the US were talking about and discovering these practices and writing them down. And I just devoured it, right? I just spent 2 weeks just reading all about this. And then kind of ever since then, I just started trying to sneak in these practices like TDD and pair programming into whatever job I had, even if it wasn't kind of legitimate.
What do you mean not legitimate or illegitimate in that context?
So this was a classic waterfall shop, right? They did three releases a year, like on the 4-month cycle. They actually always had two releases going at any one time. So you were doing like the requirements phase of this one while you were doing the testing and integration phase of that one. And so they were always in this kind of loop and they took 6 months to do a release, I should say. And they went through these really, really clear phases. So this is like a very, very, very traditional shop. So, you know, for example, the idea of two people sitting together at a computer to solve a problem, like habitually as the default way of working was just not the way they were used to people thinking about things and doing things. Writing tests, like automated tests for your code was, again, just not a way they thought about doing things. I don't even know whether the VBScript, ASP pages framework that we were using had any affordances for testability. I can't remember.
around that time, you got involved in the Cucumber open source project, I think. Could you share a little bit more about your involvement with that project and how that got started?
Yeah, well, when I was at the BBC, I did a big project for them, the online catalog. And we'd used TDD in pairing a lot. I had Jason Gorman there as a mentor of mine that was working at the BBC at the time, taught me a huge amount. And somewhere around the end of that project, we sort of realized we had this need for like full stack tests. Some people call them end-to-end tests. And we hired a guy who was like a specialist. We were all writing in C# at the time. And he started using Ruby with some old browser automation library that's now gone out of my head. And he was using RSpec. And I got exposed to RSpec and started reading about it. And I watched these videos by people in the RSpec project talking about this idea of trying to create tests that could also be read by people. And so I'd had this experience now from doing this project there, which was like 2 years of doing TDD, of still feeling like there was a gap. Like, we can talk about, you know, your problems, and then I'll go and write some tests, but you can't feed back to me whether I've written the right test. What if I misunderstood you? The tests that I've written, I'm sure that the software does those things and I can refactor safely. But what if I wrote the wrong test? We've still got like a really slow feedback loop where we basically have to wait until I've got working software and I can show it to you, which might take days or even weeks. And I would still have that experience of like, I misunderstood, I've gone and TDD'd a whole bunch of code and it was the wrong thing. I shouldn't have even built it. So that was still frustrating. And so the RSpec folk, like trying to create a project where the tests could be read by non-technical people, which is fascinating to me. And I was really attracted to the culture around the RSpec project. And so I got Aslak, who started the Cucumber project. He was on the RSpec core team. He created this thing called the RSpec Story Runner. And then he realized that it really needed to stand alone as its own thing. So he pulled it out as Cucumber. And I was like the third user of Cucumber because I'd been kind of following this narrative. We were just about to do a big rewrite at Songkick. They'd had a kind of prototype app, but they wanted to start again. And we rebuilt the entire thing using Cucumber to drive, figuring out what the requirements were, and then acceptance test driving, which, you know, we later kind of started to call BDD.
I'm assuming that you are following this narrative and user number three, not because you happen to sit next to these folks. So tell me a little bit more about how you got started in building the Cucumber Limited business around this project and what it was like to collaborate with those folks back in those times.
Yeah, well, there's two things, right? There's Cucumber, the open source project, and then there's Cucumber Limited, the business. And I got involved in the open source project first as a user who was writing answers on the mailing list, basically, because I felt like I'd always been kind of drawn to open source and curious about it. But this is the first time I'd really been like involved in an open source project and felt close to it. And I wanted to contribute, give something back. And really the only thing I could contribute or give back, because I was a novice Ruby programmer at the time, I was a user and I was quite a lot further along the learning curve than many of the other users who were joining the project and asking questions. So I viewed my contribution as being just answering questions. And that eventually led to David Chalimsky, who was the lead of the RSpec project, suggesting that I should write the book about Cucumber. So I did, which is a really fun project. That was published in 2011. And this funny thing happens when you've written a book is people assume that you must know what you're talking about. And they just kind of contact you out of the blue. And because BDD Gherkin was really kind of taking off and resonating with lots and lots of people, I started to get inquiries for coming and delivering like consulting and training. I quickly ended up with like more work than I could handle and started delegating it to some friends. And one of those friends was Aslak, who has started the Cucumber project. And another one was Julian, who'd written the JavaScript port of Cucumber. So one conversation led to another, and we ended up changing the business's name from Matt Wynn Limited to Cucumber Limited. And the three of us became co-founders. And then we sort of tried to create this virtuous circle of, you know, going out and helping teams and companies to adopt these practices and use the tool successfully, and then use that to plow money back into, you know, time that we could spend on the open source project.
That's really cool. And I think it's helpful for listeners to understand your perspective, because I think we're going to talk a lot about how to do synchronous collaboration well in a little bit. And it's useful to know, I think, that you have a rich experience doing asynchronous kind of like open source collaboration. Because I'm assuming at that time you were doing mostly PR reviews asynchronously.
Well, yeah, it is interesting though, right? Because Aslak and I, at least, and I think Julian too, really came from an XP background. Like Aslak was at ThoughtWorks back in the day. So, you know, Qcon is test-driven and it's a tool. Although a lot of people use misuse Cucumber as a sort of test after a thing that makes it a bit easier to automate Selenium scripts, it was always designed for doing test-driven development where, you know, you start with a customer acceptance test and then you go into a kind of inner loop of TDD and unit tests and you pop back out, right, great, my customer test is now passing. Although we were physically distributed on the open source team, like Aslak was in Norway at the time, I think, when it started, and I was in Scotland. I actually got involved in the project in the beginning, like as a contributor, when we met up in person. I went to Agile 2009 in Chicago, and I bought Aslak a bottle of whiskey to say, you know, thanks. And we spent a lot of time together and got to know each other in person. And I think even before that, we'd probably been collaborating quite a lot over IRC, as well as this asynchronous thing that inevitably has to happen on open source projects. So it was a mix.
Fast forward to today, where you're at Mechanical Orchard. Could you just give me a quick rundown of what the company does and what your team or the project that you're currently staffed on looks like, so that people can orient around what today looks like?
So we do legacy modernization. And like a concrete example of that is right now I work on a project for a client. That's a retailer in the US. They're a household name. They've got about 1,800 outlets across the US. So like most small towns have got one. And a lot of their core infrastructure, for example, their inventory system runs on a mainframe. So they use a DB2 database for the back end. And they've got hundreds, if not maybe into the thousands, of these overnight batch jobs that run periodically to like process the numbers from the day before and deliver new data to the systems. So what we are doing is we are taking that legacy system. It's intractable, right? Like they have had, I think, three attempts with different consultancies to come in and try and like turn this mess of COBOL into something new, because I think it can't change anymore. That's what they're stuck with, right? Like some of it's 30 years old. And the people that know it are either have already retired or they've left the company. They're down to like a tiny scratch team of people that actually know this code. And so it's becoming unchangeable. And they obviously, as a business, need to be able to keep changing it. So trying to get onto a new platform is essential for them, as well as the costs, right? So like these mainframe systems cost a lot of money to rent from IBM.
Okay, so you've got this current project where they're facing a challenge where you've got a skeleton crew of people who even know how to update this code or have any historical context on what was done and how any of it works. Is that kind of the typical project that you see?
Yes. This is a really familiar story. The other one I was looking at the other day is a HP Nonstop. If you look up about HP Nonstop, it came out of a Silicon Valley startup in 1974 called Tandem that was acquired by various companies and is now owned by HP. And it's a similar sort of thing. You know, the technology is really old. There's not that many people around even on the job market that know it. And it's really like hard to work with.
Let's talk about how you guys work together. How does a project like this even go down? If there's so few people on the market who know about this stuff, there's so few people inside the company who know about this stuff, where do you come in and add value? And how do you work with the people who are there?
Yeah, so I mean, we're learning a lot about it, because at least like in the early days, we were literally just reading the COBOL and then test driving a new implementation. We use Elixir mostly, although we're pretty flexible. So we've got projects in C# and Java, depending on what the client wants. But if we're going to, our preferred model is we'll take your old system, rewrite it for you, and then we'll run it for you, because we want that like benefit of having done test-driven development and knowing that this code is well-factored, that we can then carry on maintaining it and changing it for you in the future. What we had been doing was just like reading the code, trying to figure out what it did, making a new implementation. And then with the batch jobs particularly, we have this model of doing what we call equivalence testing, where we basically deploy the new version side by side with the running production system. They get the same inputs, right? So it's like a nightly job. It gets a file, comes in, and then the new version is writing to a stub. So it doesn't actually have any side effects on the running system yet, but we measure the equivalence between the outputs from the real one and the outputs from our new version. And then we can actually just kind of loop round. So, you know, a new case comes through the system on a Thursday night and we're like, oh, we've had a failure in equivalence. Now we've got a new test case and we can take that away and test drive the changes. And eventually, you know, we reach a point where we're satisfied that the two are equivalent enough. So that's like one methodology we've been using. But the other one that we've been starting to get into as well, Michael Feathers wrote this great book about working with legacy code. And that book is predominantly for taking a legacy code base and like making it so that you could safely change it. And we don't generally do that. What we do is we take a legacy system and we figure out what it does, and then we make a new one. Fundamentally, we don't want it made of COBOL anymore. So it has to get rewritten. And this is the classic mistake to make, right? Is a big rewrite. And we need to do it iteratively. And so one of the skills that I see, because lots and lots of people from Mechanical Orchard worked for Rob Mee. He's the founder of Mechanical Orchard. They worked for him at Pivotal Labs, which is like the classic consulting company from the XP Agile sort of first wave. So we've got a lot of really, really skillful people in this space, and the product managers being able to take, you know, these big problem domains, these mainframe systems that are doing like everything for the organization, and slice those up and find like, oh, look, here's a piece of it that we could separate out and take and port for you to a new system, and you can move these users over. And we could do this in like a 6-month window. That's the kind of thing that we're doing. So we're trying to find these slices in the big problem.
How do you structure the way that you work together such that this isn't a total disaster? Because as you said, this is like classically what you would recommend not to do.
Yeah. Well, like I say, finding those thin slices is really important. I think also developing relationships with the client and the experts of the client is really important. So like one of the characteristics of a Mechanical Orchard employee that has drawn me to the organization, and I feel such affection for my colleagues really, is that we're in this kind of quadrant of like, everybody is super sharp, like really good at their jobs, but also really kind, like just really personable, emotionally mature people. Like, and so we're naturally like good at doing things like pairing with each other, but we're also really good at like engaging with the clients. And actually, like in the early days of this project, we spent a lot of time pairing with the 60 something COBOL programmers that work at the client to help them help us to figure out, you know, our way around this dark cavern that we were starting to explore.
Well, and Mechanical Orchard's completely remote and distributed. Is that correct?
We do have an office in San Francisco, and I think it would probably fit like a third of the company if they were all there at the same time. Maybe a bit more than that. We had a sort of big in-person meetup for the 30-odd people that work on this client back in September at the office, and there was enough room for all of us. It was good.
Nice. Okay, so there's 30 people working on this project, and there's 60 COBOL developers, give or take, over there. Walk me through how you guys work together.
I work on a tools team for my team. So most of the time, I'm taking away things that we've noticed as friction and building tools to make those things smoother. So for example, the system that we're working with, this IBM mainframe, has a user interface called KIX, Customer Information Control System. And it really is actually quite a lot like a web browser architecture. So you have a terminal, or you would have had a terminal in the olden days. Nowadays, you have a terminal emulator that speaks the X3270 protocol. It's like a classic green screen, right? Except it does have colors. And you might see this if you like look over the shoulder of someone working at a bank, or even my local hardware store has a KIX user interface, I think, for their inventory system and the checkouts. And we built an automation library, so effectively like Selenium for an X3270 terminal emulator. So we can write, from Michael Feather's book, characterization tests that help us to learn what does the old system do by walking the screens as a user would, filling in things, seeing what the user sees. And we can take that characterization information and then turn that into an acceptance test for the new system. So we know we're, you know, we're building the same behavior. So that's an example of a tool that, my team's built. And we're kind of like a team within a team. So there's two or three of us working in a team of like overall 12 or 14 people. We've got one product manager, one designer, and kind of everybody else is just a, you know, full stack engineer. And then we are one of three teams working direct on delivery for this client. The other two are doing the batch side, which is like the back end. And there's just tons of those, and they're really sort of hard and they're like a big deal. So we've got two teams running at that and one team running at the user interface.
I want to talk more about communication, collaboration, and its role in driving effective teams. I know it's something that's near and dear to your heart. Let's start with parent ensemble programming or social programming broadly. How important are these types of practices to driving effective teams?
Yeah, so for me personally, they're absolutely crucial. And one of the things I was looking for when I took the job at Mechanical Orchard, so we went through this whole journey with Cucumber Limited. We built a consulting business for about 6 years. Where I traveled the world going into organizations and trying to help them adopt agile practices like TDD, BDD, many other things too. We were acquired in 2019 and I spent 3 years or so working at the acquirer, 3 or 4 years, Smart Bear Software, and actually got the opportunity there to just run the open source project. But when that was over 2 years ago now, I really didn't know what to do. Like, because I'd had this experience of, you know, building this company and being a consultant and kind of going into lots of other organizations. And the sort of obvious thing was, oh, well, I'll tout myself again as like a consultant, because I know it's nice that you can get a good day rate. You know, you get quite a lot of autonomy over your time. But the more I started to think about it, the more depressed I became really at the idea of trying to facilitate change in these organizations that are often so resistant to it and so sort of like ungrateful. Like, you're trying to do something that could be wonderful and yet the organization is just like fighting you. There's just these forces in the organization that are just fighting you all the time. I started to realize that what I really wanted was just to find somewhere where everybody already gets it and then we can do great things. Like, what does that look like? And so I found Mechanical Orchard because a friend of mine recommended it. He said, oh, Kent Beck's at this new company, why don't you check it out? And yeah, it feels like a really good fit. And because it really was me saying, like, the thing I want is I want to go somewhere where pairing and social programming, I really like that expression, is just natural. That's what everybody does normally, rather than you having to like try and sell it. And explain to people why it's good. Like, let's just get on with it and then what great things can we do with it?
Can you share a specific example of how social programming has made such a big difference for a team that you worked on?
What I see on this project that I'm working on is we've had like a certain amount of turnover in the team because the organization is growing. So some people who are senior end up, you know, needing to go off and lead other projects where, you know, new hires will come in and sort of augment our team and get absorbed into it. So there's been this kind of fluidity to the organization evolving, right? It's probably almost doubled in size. I think we're just over 100 people now. And that has happened so sort of organically and naturally. And the code on the project that I'm working on, it still feels like something that everybody has ownership over every line in it. And I think that sense of collective ownership over the code is something that you have to have experienced to know how magical it is. Or you have to have experienced the opposite, because I mean, some of these kids that are coming in, right? They don't know how lucky they are. You have to experience the opposite to know how dreadful and miserable it is when there are large parts of the code that are just like a mystery. You're building your own legacy. Right, you're building your own legacy code where people are scared to go in and touch bits of the system. So I think that is huge for us, that this code base all looks like it was built by the same person, because like basically the standards in it are the same and there's no bit of it that any one of us, even someone that's been on the team for like a few weeks, there's no bit of it that any one of us is afraid to go and touch. Obviously there are bits that some, you know, some people know them better than others, But in general, that like belief and trust in the code and knowledge of it is really well distributed across the team, which gives us superpowers for being able to keep doing the work even when, you know, somebody's absent or somebody has to leave. It gives the organization superpowers, right? Because somebody can lead the team and go and lead another team, bring the good ideas from that team to another team without it being too disruptive.
Does the importance of pairing and mobbing change when a team's in person versus remote to you?
I would say almost if anything, it's probably more important in a remote context. Like I think that remote work could be really lonely, and I imagine it probably is for a lot of people. And I don't experience that at all. I actually had my meeting notifier just remind me that we have friendship break. Every day we just take 15 minutes out to just connect with each other. You know, sometimes we play a game or we just chat about what everybody did at the weekend. And I think that's kind of a nice signal of the culture on this team that like we value the relationships we have with each other because we recognize that that's how, you know, the trust that comes from those good relationships is like how we become a high functioning team.
Do you think that trust is inherent if you're pairing or ensembling regularly?
I don't know if it's inherent. I think you have to work at it. I think that you can definitely get toxic or otherwise sort of negative dynamics that can happen in pairs and ensembles. I have got a really good funny story about an ensemble. There's kind of two related stories from like the early days. So do you remember this idea of a coding dojo that came up? I went to a couple of conferences where we tried to do it. And one of them was this room full of consultants. They all took turns in pairs to solve this problem. And there was a lot of egos in that room. And it was just hilarious to see how this solution to what was actually like quite a straightforward problem, right? Would just get pulled back and forth depending on who was sitting at the keyboard. And each new guy, and it was usually a guy that came and sat down at the keyboard, would like take the solution in a completely different direction. And we got nowhere. You know, all these like really experienced consultants got basically nowhere in solving the problem. And shortly after that, I also had this experience where I ran a session at the London Ruby user group, which I used to go to a lot. We broke into two groups, huddled around a projector, and I guess it was probably like 15, 20 people in each group. And again, like doing this like Randori style where you'd have like maybe 5 minutes, I'm driving, you're navigating, and then when the 5 minute time goes off, you start driving, I go and sit in the crowd, someone else comes out of the crowd to navigate, and we keep rotating around every 5 minutes. And it was amazing, these two groups, right? Maybe there was three even. So one of them, in the time we had, I think we had like 45 minutes or an hour or something, one group just like basically solved the problem. So they got kind of to the end. This other group got to the end and beyond. They started adding new features and they really like ran with it and embellished it. And then this third group got nowhere. Like they hadn't even basically solved the problem. And it was clear to me from walking around the room that the difference was in the dynamic in the groups. There were a couple of egos in that dysfunctional group where these two people were like, it was about them rather than about the group getting something done. And then, you know, the group that was embellishing things, which is they were having fun. It was like a creative, playful thing for them, right? The dynamic is really interesting. And I personally have experienced that work of pairing or trying to learn to pair and learn to ensemble is like it's healthy for you, right? Like it's good for you. You can learn more about yourself and how you collaborate with others. So I think it's a good thing, but it requires people to be open to that, I guess.
If you're a developer who wants to start pairing or ensembling with your team, what advice would you offer to make sure they don't end up like that third group that gets basically nowhere and instead feels like one of those first two, where it's a creative, playful pursuit where folks are working together effectively? What advice would you offer to somebody who's trying to get started pairing or mobbing?
I think what you need to do is create safe spaces. Like one common story I've heard from lots of people who are new to pairing and have kind of had an epiphany of like why this is great. I never realized how much other people Google for stuff or look on Stack Overflow, or I guess these days maybe use a GPT or whatever. I always thought it was just me. And becoming vulnerable in front of your colleagues like that and exposing what you don't know can be surprisingly difficult if you come from a culture, if the organizational culture is generally one where like it's not safe to look stupid in front of people. So trying to create a space where it's safe to look stupid is like crucial, I think. And that's something you can practice by, like, maybe you just block out an hour at lunchtime for a brown bag session where you're going to solve a toy coding challenge, like one of those CATA challenges I talked about, together as a group, because the pressure's off, right? It's just lunchtime. It's not even real code. It's just a toy problem. We're just going to learn together. And that can be a good way to like set the atmosphere right, to help people to discover what these practices can be good for and when they can work without there being a lot of pressure on it. So I think that can be a good way to start.
And then tactically, are there any things that you'd advise around how you invite other people to participate?
So there's this great book, Agile Coaching, Rachel Davis and Liz Sedley wrote. Their advice in there about like proposing any change is you need to first start with the problem and find a problem that people will acknowledge and recognize as a problem. And then your change can be proposed as an experiment to maybe solve that problem. So what are the kinds of problems that we might have if we're not doing enough pairing? Maybe it's we're not very resilient to people being away. Like maybe it was a problem that particular task or story got stuck for 2 weeks while that one person who was the only person with knowledge about it was on vacation. Or maybe we lost somebody from the team and there's a whole area of the code that we know we've been struggling to change because nobody knows it very well. Trying to find some of those like problems to start with, get people to see and acknowledge and recognize those problems. And then you can say, oh, well, you know, how about if we try pairing on it and maybe the knowledge will spread faster around the team? Those are the kinds of things I think that can work.
And that's just good sales, right? Like convincing somebody of something is not about making a really compelling, you know, speech. It's more about identifying the problems at play that can be solved with some particular solution.
It's important to empathize and understand and connect with the pain before you start pushing a solution.
Yeah. And so in this case, if the goal is to get folks interested in pairing, ensembling, taking a look around at some of the challenges the team's faced and seeing if you can position the practice as a potential solution to that challenge would be your best piece of advice, which I think makes a lot of sense. I like that quite a bit.
That was the other thing that, you know, I talked about that before. I had a legit agile job was just sneaking it in. Just find the individuals that you know are more personable and actually probably quite like working together on stuff and see if you can find some reasons to just work together on things and get some practice for yourself, right? And get your own confidence up and try and like gather some evidence of success.
What's your top piece of advice for folks to make the most out of working remotely or on a distributed team?
Well, I think it's really important to connect as humans. I did this really great course a couple of years ago on remote facilitation. Virtual facilitation is the course if you want to Google it. That's their brand. And it's really, really good. And the course was run remotely itself. Obviously, there was a lot of examples of how to do good remote work in the workshop itself, in the way the workshop ran. And one of the things I realized was they made a big effort to connect us all, this group of strangers that came together for this fairly short period to do this training. Actually, like on quite intimate level, like I'd been in a side conversation in a breakout with someone about like how family life had been growing up, right? And so all of a sudden, this like random white lady from somewhere in the US who was on a Zoom call with me with another dozen people and was just basically like a block of pixels on my screen, right? All of a sudden, when she was speaking, she had this whole like depth to her that made me so much more engaged with what she had to say and what she thought than I would have been if we'd have been, you know, strangers as we had been at the beginning of the course. So that really struck me as important and also something that's so easy to neglect in a remote context, right? Because we take for granted in a physical environment, we're going to be bumping into people. We're going to be maybe in the kitchen and having a chat, or maybe we decide to go for lunch together. That kind of thing just doesn't happen unless you're deliberate about it in a remote context. So I think it's really important to like make time to connect.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I spoke to somebody who we're having on the pod who talked about for their stand-up, the beginning of every stand-up, they take turns come in with like a goofy icebreaker question. It was actually an engineer at Spotify. They do this and they'll devote 15 minutes every stand up to talk about some goofy question. And it can be totally outlandish and wild and unwork related. And in doing so, you have the opportunity to share all of these different aspects about your personal life and experience that maybe aren't as emotionally charged or meaningful as was the case in the particular example that you shared. But on a team, if you're doing that every day, much like the 15-minute friendship block that you shared that you're missing right now, it's like to have this conversation, it adds up and it starts to lead to, I think, more meaningful relationships.
Yeah, and I think it reduces the fatigue. It's harder to pay attention to a set of pixels on a screen than it is to pay attention to a real physical human being in front of you. And I think that fatigue is reduced when you know that person better and you care about them. It's easier to imagine the whole person there, I think.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, again, Matt, we're coming up on time here. So I just want to thank you for being generous with your time and perspective. It's always great catching up. If folks want to learn more about you or any of the projects or work that you've done, where should they go?
Yeah, I have a website. It's old school, right? But mattwynne.net, mattwynne.net. And if you go on there, I mean, there's some of my writing, but also you can find a contact link where there's links to wherever I hang out on the internet these days. It mostly seems to be Blue Sky at the moment.
We'll link to that in the show notes so folks can find it. So thank you again for coming on, Matt. And we'll chat again soon, I hope.
Yeah, pleasure. It was a really fun conversation. Thanks, Jack.
Cheers. Thanks for joining us on Distributed. If you want to learn more about what we covered in this episode, or if you want to share your own thoughts, follow @Tuple on X or visit distributed.fm.